I am the best wrestler in the world. I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company, and I've been vilified and hated since that day because Paul Heyman saw something in me that nobody else wanted to admit. I've grabbed so many of Vincent K. McMahon's imaginary brass rings that it's finally dawned on me that they're just that. They're completely imaginary. The only thing that's real is me, and the fact that day in and day out, for almost 6 years, I have proved to everybody in the world that I am the best on this microphone, in that ring, even in commentary. Nobody can touch me.
And Jeff can't teach that, so you better recognize. Here with a brand new episode of CM Jew's Wrestling Reviews. This is episode 78. We are officially in summer, and on this episode, we take summer to the max, American style, as it's time for a bath. It's time for a great American bash. That's why we're going to the storied history of the WCW pay-per-view, the Great American Bash, which also, first of all, why was a WWE pay-per-view, but what pay-per-view are we going to? Well, I thought it'd be time to take a look at a pay-per-view that is of legend, because it has two very important historical attributes, well, a couple of important historical attributes, but the ones I care about are, one, it is the WCW debut of one Rey Mysterio Jr., and I swear to God, if those long care guys are coming back this way after stalling me for a half hour, I'm gonna do some John Cena stunners on some people. This Great American Bash is also known as the time where Kevin Nash and Scott Hall powerbombed Eric Bischoff through a table. Yes, I am, of course, talking about the last pay-per-view before the historic Bash at the Beach of 1996, the Great American Bash 1996. And a couple of very important story attributes happened. There was also the consolidation of the new Four Horsemen. And I think, well, this only runs kind of also established the beginning point for a feud between the Four Horsemen and the Dungeon of Doom, which had been starting beforehand, but it's sort of a progression of that story. But there, two members were solidified into that spot. I mean, of course, you had Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, but there are two more members. We'll get to those members here. Again, like I said, it's the debut of, honestly, one of my top three wrestlers of all time and top three favorite wrestlers of all time, in both those sort of categories. And that is Rey Mysterio Jr., of course, now known as Rey Mysterio. And again, also, it's the sort of last pay-per-view before the legendary Bash at the Beach 1996, as I implied, which, of course, that's where the NWO officially started. I mean, this was still during the sort of invasion storyline of Nash and Hall, but the NWO hadn't been officially started yet. Or at least for my money, I start the NWO officially at Bash on the Beach 1996, because that's where they won, that's where Hogan's like, you can call this brother the end, the new world order of professional wrestling, brother. So yeah, very historic pay-per-view. We have that. Of course, last weekend was Extreme Rules, by the way. And just a couple of short thoughts, I'm not going to give a full review on it. But I thought Extreme Rules was actually kind of enjoyable in some spots. I mean, obviously worst match of the night was Bayley versus Alexa Bliss. Because it's such a digression of her character. And the Singapore Kane on a pole match. I'm surprised they didn't put... I'm surprised at this point that they didn't put the Singapore Kane on a forklift. And you all knew... I'm sure everybody was thinking that. Actually, that would have made the match better, because then we could have all just sung, "And she tried to kill her with a forklift. Huzzah!" But, I mean... I do also agree with one other thing. I think a lot of people have sort of made the joke of wanky rules instead of extreme rules, because they're like, I don't think that's how this match is supposed to work. But all in all, I, for the most part, enjoyed most of the matches. I enjoyed the Intercontinental match. I enjoyed the Tag Team Cage match. Again, wanky rules in both of those. Trying to remember what other matches there were there. But I know there were more. But I'm completely picking them. But yeah, obviously the highlight of that night was that fatal five-way. I really enjoyed it. Of course, Samoa Joe is your new number one contender. And after last Raw, by the way, in that promo with Paul Heyman, yeah, hey, Lesnar... I just have one thing I want to tell you. Joe is gonna kill you. Joe is gonna kill you. Which, by the way, Bill Goldberg, by this time in his title run, had defended the Universal title more times than Brock Lesnar has in his title run so far. I mean, yes, that one title run was a month later and he lost it, but still, he's defended it more times, as far as I'm concerned, than Brock Lesnar. But that here, here nor there. I mean, it's not like Shin Tiger Curl is going to hear this and dispute this with me, which would be stupid because he'd be wrong then. I love you, Shin, but you're wrong. And yes, folks, I do still rub in that Goldberg technically has a winning record over Brock Lesnar. Technically, Goldberg is 2-1 over Lesnar. Just remember that. 2 wins to 1 loss. 3 if you include the Royal Rumble. I'm just saying he lasted longer than Lesnar. As far as where they were eliminated, at least. But again, me gushing about Bill Goldberg's complete domination of Brock Lesnar's side. Yeah. So, I enjoyed Extreme Rules. I can't believe I'm saying this. I'm looking forward to WWE Raw's Great Balls of Fire. I'm also looking forward to Money in the Bank. So, there's a lot of things to look forward to. The other thing that happened over the course of the, since I last recorded, was the finals for the Best of the Super Juniors. And, whoo, you want to talk about being happy in your head, please. Absolutely fantastic finals match. I'm also going to, by the way, short plug for the WrestleCast. I will be talking about this probably a little bit more in depth on the WrestleCast, which I'll be on the very next episode. But, yeah, the entire Special Super Juniors was outstanding. Really enjoyed it. They had a lot of intensity, especially that last day of, like, who's going to come out of B block. And I guess for Kushida, just got lucky. The right people won that he could move on. It really gave it that sort of sports feel to it. And then Will Ospreay versus Kushida 3, basically, because, you know, they had those two matches last year which are outstanding. But I didn't get to see those. I actually do want to go back and watch those. But this, my God. Will Ospreay has just a knack for just, like, pulling moves out that you've never seen before. It's... The thing that's strange is that I connect sort of someone like Kalisto or Ricochet more with being very Rey Mysterio-esque. But Will Ospreay in his own way is, or at least in that sense, is a bit Rey Mysterio-esque. I mean, it's not like I have Rey Mysterio on my brain right now, but, you know, that's here and there. But, yeah, just an outstanding match. I mean, there's a spot where he knocks Kushida off. Like, it's like he's on the street, and then that reverse Hurricane Rana where he spikes Kushida's head on the apron. Like, God damn, please don't die. Just the moves. It looked like, okay, he's dead. And that ending. Again, spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it, but the tucking of the head between the and the turnbuckle, the sort of vintage Ospreay move, and then just the 12 kicks to the head, and yet Kushida still had the mindset to be able to block Ospreay's attempt of whatever he was going to do. Hit Back to the Future off the top rope, roll through, hit Back to the Future again, which, by the way, for those who don't know what Back to the Future is, small package driver, also known as God's Last Gift. He calls it Back to the Future, gets the 1-2-3. And also what I really loved was I loved the celebration. That celebration afterwards where the junior heavyweights that were out there, like Dragon Lee, Valdor Jr., Tiger Mask, Jushin Thunder Liger, ACH, who was very, very excited about doing the Japanese clap. Which, by the way, I just made that sound a whole lot dirtier than it should. It's phrasing, as Tito probably saying. Ricochet, like I said, Ricochet was there, and all pretty much the good guys were there, and yeah, their celebration with him going to the crowd celebrating, but it was just a good thing. And that whole final show, which had a lot of build up to Dominion, which is taking place Saturday night, Sunday morning. I'm looking forward to watching that. So yeah, had a lot of build up to that. The Kenny Omega, Marty Skrull, Okada Kazuchika. Ghetto tag match, hell of that. But, by the way, if in case I forget to say it on the WrestleCast, I hope I don't, I'm going to say it here, special MVP to the camera crew on the matches in particular, during that 8-man Bullet Club tag match, against War Machine, ACH, and David Finlay, in particular at the end, where Yujiro Takashi gets the win, and Bunny Girl, who, as I've established before, please tell me her name, I will buy everything she wants to sell me, which, again, sounds a whole lot dirtier than I'm trying to make it to be. It's supposed to be dirty, but not that dirty, but that's besides the point. I will buy, when I say buy anything she wants to sell me, I mean DVDs. I mean, movies, photo sets, you know, the normal stuff. Not the creepy stuff. But that aside, yeah, he got that perfect shot of that ass as it just dove into the ring, into his arms. I'm like, Thank you, cameraman. Chicken's done. The finals for Best of the Super Juniors were absolutely outstanding. The entire show had fun watching it. And looking forward to Dominion this weekend. It should be a good show. Speaking of what could be called a good show, we'll find out with the review. That brings us to today's topic, which is Bash, Great America. I almost said Bash at the Beach, and I said, we've already reviewed that. The Great American Bash, 1996, which took place on Sunday, June 16th, 1996, to an attendance of 19,000 at the Baltimore Arena in Baltimore, Maryland, the pretty typical place for most Great American Bash. And I think it was pretty much a staple that Baltimore hosted the Great American Bash. As I, I'm trying to look, but like it all has it in short things. And I'm not going to look that up now. But yeah, I know for 1990 it was there. And it, for the most part, with the pretty typical host of the Great American Bash. Your calling card entire team for the evening was Tony Schiavone and the American Dream, baby, Dusty Rhodes. With all that being said, let's get into the Great American Bash 1996. Booyaka, booyaka, 619, hey, booyaka, booyaka, that's my pueblo, booyaka, booyaka, 619, hey. Ya llegó el Rey Misterio, Pato Cabrón de San Diego. Mash up on the scene like the Brown Crusader, blowing up screens like Space Invaders. Too much damage for one to manage. Going 5150, speaking Spanglish. Hasta un lado estoy pesado, vivo la vida peleando pecado. Estados Unidos al otro lado, a bola Canadá, 619 sold out. For my people, yeah, you gotta love it. Mexican across the stomach, so think nothing of it but love it. Lucha, de la calle a la lucha. Siempre represento con mi chacho y cachucha. 619, Simón, that's my cora. San Diego, Puerto Rico, Sinaloa. Puyaka, puyaka, 619, hey. Puyaka, puyaka, that's my pueblo. Puyaka, puyaka, 619, hey. Puyaka, puyaka, Rey Misterio. What you gonna do when we come for you? Correle, correle, andale. What you gonna do when we come for you?
And welcome back, and let's get right into it. I actually do have, a couple of notes, folks, so this is going to be really interesting. May actually go faster than I usually do. We'll see how long I talk on certain subjects and whatnot. By the way, I don't have papers to shuffle to prove it because I didn't print them out. I have them right here on my laptop. usually I have it like I put the notes in my mind. I don't have them in front of me. So sometimes I forget notes that I had put down before. And in the case like with this, to where I actually wait 3 or 4 days to do the recording after watching the full thing, you sometimes forget stuff. So here, I don't have anything that I've forgotten. Everything that I wrote down, including the fact that I apparently can't spell the word interest. Which, funny, because, that's a very sloppy thing to do, and that really describes our first match. The Steiner Brothers versus Fire and Ice, which was a tag team match to determine the number one contender for the WCW World Tag Team Championship, which took place for 10 minutes and 29 seconds. Just quick overview, there were let's call them pre-show matches because they happened on the WCW main event, which was before the show. Rocco Rock defeated Jerry Sags of the Nasty Boys. VK Wall Street defeated Jim Powers. And Jim Duggan defeated Disco Inferno. Disco Inferno. Disco Inferno. Disco Inferno. Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay, I'm 31 years old and I can still remember that song. God, what have I done with my life? Okay, moving on. Yeah, like I said, a very sloppy match. And a slow match. It's beef on beef, baby. I mean, and it shouldn't be that. I mean, it's Scott Norton. It's the Steiners. It should feel bigger and better than this. But it felt very slow. It felt very sloppy. Scott Norton looked blown up. Like, within 2 or 3 minutes of him coming in, and looked like by the end that he had no interest in this match. Like, he looked like he had no interest. He looked blown up. I don't know if that's part of his character, or anything, but yeah, he did not look like he wanted to be there. And there is something to be said, by the way, about body language. And this is, I think, going to be a key point for a couple matches, is, or for that matter, for in particular, the first two. And that is that body image is everything. Now, mind you, you can have a body image of, like, you don't want to be there and actually be part of something in story, which we will kind of get to later. But, you know, body language is very important, because you got to remember, again, these are you know, sports entertainers, and part of sports entertaining, yeah, you got to know the moves, and you got to be able to tell a story through wrestling moves. But again, it's that listening to the crowd, reacting to the crowd, being able to just with the crowd, and part of that is body language. And, you know, the crowd can tell when you really don't care and when you don't want to be there. And it just seemed, in particular with Scott Norton, that he did not want to be there. Like I said, he was blown up, and by me saying blown up, I mean, he was, it seemed like he was gasping for air. Like, he was tired and had enough of this ish. A-Train really seemed like the most high energy in this match, and really the only one that seemed to kind of want to be there. And of course you had the Steiners, who are always crazy. But yeah, and just sloppiness, there was a lot of botching, the match was very slow developing, and just didn't seem like it was going to go anywhere. And so, yeah, just, and that ending, the ending was so confusing, the botch on the Hurricane Rana, Norton not knowing, I don't know whether it was Norton not knowing how to take it, or just didn't want to take it, but just, like, took it and took the pin and then rolled out very quickly and just started walking. Like, looked like he had had enough of this and he was ready to go home. Again, this is why I go back to Scott Norton looking like he wanted no interest in this match. I don't know why it was, but it was very telling. And it was, yeah, I know the opening match is supposed to, you know, build stuff up, get people started, everything. It did nothing to get me started. Which, depending on how you take that sentence, is probably a good thing. our next match was for the WCW United States Championship, as Conan faced El Gato in a match that lasted 6 minutes, 3 seconds. This was slightly better than that, but again, there just didn't feel like there was a lot of chemistry here. And that led to some botching. The ending was very strange with Conan. I don't know. He hit, I'm trying to remember what he hit. It wasn't a tiger suplex, but it was a very weird thing where Gato fell off the, got taken off the apron by Conan, and there was like, a Northern Light suplex or something like that, and he got the pin, and he just rolled out and didn't even wait to get the bell. Just rolled out and, like, waved to the fans as he went to the back. And it was very sudden. Like, there was no build-up to it. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with, there was just very much of a lack of chemistry. between these two wrestlers. I'm actually looking up Elgato now. Pat Tanaka. Pat Tanaka of the Oriental Express. No wonder. I know he's had a very long career, leading back to 1984, but yeah, you just tried to pass a Hawaiian off as a Mexican. Wrestling at its finest. You know, these are the type of things I should probably be looking up before I do the review. And I might have a better thing. I really should have, yeah. It still goes to it. There is no chemistry whatsoever between El Gato, a.k.a. Pat Tanaka, and Conan. It wasn't sloppy, but there were a couple of botching, just no chemistry. Like, there was a lot of off-timing stuff. You know? I mean, they at least had the body language that they felt like they wanted to be in the match, with the exception of Pat Tanaka and El Gato. Yeah, not looking like he knew what to do, or if he kind of wanted to be there. Thankfully, things finally pick up with our third match, as we have Diamond Dallas Page versus Marcus Alexander Bagwell in a battle for the Battle Bull Ring. Now, storyline behind this is that the last pay-per-view, which was a Battle Bull event, I believe it was Spring Stampede, if I'm not mistaken. In fact, I do believe we actually reviewed this before, so please correct me if I'm wrong on this. But it like a Spring of Stampede, and Diamond Dallas Page won it. And I think like Marcus Bagwell was his brother, and tag team partner, and he double crossed him, or something along those lines. So I apologize for forgetting again stuff I probably should have done before recording. So obviously I didn't complete my notes. I was so happy that I actually did some notes this time that I forgot the other notes I probably should have checked. But yeah, so Battle for the Battle Bull Ring. This is sort of DDP's rise. And this is why, to me, this match is very interesting. Because this is all part of that sort of, you know, he's still kind of, still heel. But it's part of DDP's rise to the main event and the main scene. As, you know, it's him developing what we know as DDP Classic. And I say that, like, the DDP that we all know and love, that good guy DDP, with the blue and black trunks and everything, like, this is still sort of very colorful, very former pimp-esque DDP, the sort of DDP that we saw, or had been seen for, in a way, for years, or the past couple of years in WCW. But this is sort of that start to the extension to what, how I think we remember DDP in WCW. In particular because, you know, this was build and build, and of course you would have that moment where DDP would be asked to join the NWO, and he doesn't. And he says, nope, I'm going against you guys! And, that pushed his character to the moon. But Diamond Dallas Page versus Marcus Bagwell. If I did not say the time was 9 minutes and 39 seconds. And it was a good match. Standard mid-card fare. Again, everything around here was about building DDP and building his character. And part, I think, what helped that is there was a great storytelling by the announcers here, in particular Dusty. Because, you know, part of a match sometimes is you're telling the story of a match, and sometimes, you know, I brought this up with Wrestle Kingdom this past year about how part of the story being told in the Intercontinental match, and the announcers hit on as well, because they helped tell that story, and that's what announcers do. They help sometimes tell that part of the story that you may not always recognize as, you know, a wrestler missing on something. You know, in the case of Tanahashi, him going after the wrong leg and Naito going after the right leg. Well, in here, there is a story of the inexperience of Marcus Bagwell showing through him not going for covers. He would hit a big move and then sort of pin and show off. And Dustin, like, don't go, stop showing off, baby. Go for the cover. And, you know, DDP, you know, when he would hit a move, even a small move, he would go for a cover. And so experience versus inexperience, and Dusty highlighting that so that you can take notice of it. This is where that sort of announcer dynamic comes into helping tell the story of the match. There's a very important story element to why DDP beat Bagwell in this match, including, you know, Diamond Cutter out of nowhere. But it helped tell that story. So, you know, that really helped the match in that way. And like I said, it was a solid mid-card affair. Did a lot of focusing on DDP. Again, still heel, but, you know, still very good showing. And like I said, good to see Diamond Cutter out of nowhere to where it's a block suplex. Bagwell gets turned around, and DDP immediately hits Diamond Cutter and gets the 1-2-3. Now, our next match is obviously, if you know what the card is or looking up on Wikipedia, you know, this is the match I was looking forward to most. It is the second longest match of the night at 17 minutes and 50 seconds for the WCW World Cruiserweight Championship. We have Dean Malenko versus Rey Mysterio Jr. And oh my god, this was an outstanding match. You know, any sort of the bad energy the first two matches brought, that third match couldn't squash. Oh my god, this match did away with it and just like, oh my god, just lit the building up. Dean Malenko truly looked like a man of 1,000 holds. This is not just a good Rey Mysterio match. This is a good Dean Malenko match. Like, this is Dean Malenko in his prime. This is Dean Malenko at his best. I mean, just absolutely outstanding. And it's like, Malenko truly looked like the man of 1,000 holds. He really did. Because he pretty much, I think, used almost all of them on Rey Mysterio. And that was sort of the thing. It's like, a lot of this match is actually on the ground. And it's Malenko grinding Mysterio with hold after hold after hold after hold. Mind you, the match starts hot with Mysterio getting some very good moves in, you know, looking very even with Malenko, but he has that edge and speed until Malenko then grounds him, and it's that long climb, and they build towards that comeback happening of Malenko just grinding Mysterio to the mat with hold after hold after hold. And the selling by Mysterio is absolutely outstanding. It's like, is he tapping? Is Mysterio tapping? It's like, you don't know if he's tapping or not. But just like constantly in every hold that seems possible. And just the continued work on the arm and the arm. And just then Mysterio hits that move, starts the comeback. And it's just beautiful. The, you know, the knocking Malenko out to the outside and the springboard somersault plancha, just amazing. And the whole build to the end, like just Mysterio hitting Hurricane Ron, is it just coming this close and this close and this close to getting it, to the point to where, you know, he tries to go for a Hurricane Rana, rolls him to a victory roll position, goes to spin into a Hurricane Rana. Malenko counters it with a power bomb and taking advantage of being in the corner, that the referee is going to be out of position to see his feet, and is looking at the shoulders being pinned, puts his feet on the rope to get extra leverage for the win. I mean, it's like what I was thinking, like, you're supposed to boo him, but nobody can boo him because it was such a fantastic match, and it was a wrestler doing what he needed to do. Mysterio looked absolutely amazing, and looked like the absolute superstar that Mike today was making him out to be. Dean Malenko looked amazing as a champion. And more importantly, told this great story. This champion, it's a great champion, doesn't need to cheat, but Mysterio was so great that he needed to. And that was truly amazing in itself. And it was just absolutely outstanding. No question about it. Match of the night. Ooh, after that, I need a cool down. Speaking of cool down, that's our next match, as I call it, which was very short at, 5 minutes and 24 seconds. So, yeah, considering what the next match after it was, needed it. As Big Bubba takes on John Tenta. And I have one note for this match. And that is, I guess this is where the big boys play. So thank God it's short. It really is. It's a short match. There's really nothing to it. It involves the storyline of Big Bubba now being part of the Dungeon of Doom. And them kicking John Tenta, a.k.a. Shark Attack, a.k.a. Earthquake, out. And, you know, Big Bubba cutting John Tenta's hair. And now he ends up cutting Big Bubba's beard. Finish comes with Big Bubba, a.k.a. formerly known as Big Boss Man, but couldn't use it because WWE held the copyright. Goes for that sort of top rope splash, and kind of like what Warlord did to him once, I think at a Royal Rumble. Tenta catches and hits the power slam, gets the 1-2-3. Really short match. Like I said, this is where the big boys play. They have to have their match. So, piss break! Really, that's what it felt. It's like, my God, we just had this absolutely outstanding contest. And, we're going to have a couple big men, you know, just flog around the ring. And I hate saying that, by the way, about Big Boss Man. And for that matter, John Tenta, because they've had entertaining matches. This is just not one of them. And... yeah, people needed a break after the Cruiserweight Champion because that match was absolutely outstanding. It's the type of match where you have, like, I gotta go outside and have a cigarette because that orgasm was wonderful. And they would need it for the next match. Our next match is a Falls Count Anywhere match, which lasted 9 minutes and 58 seconds. Let's round that up to basically 10 minutes. You have Chris Benoit, who at the time was still a Four Horseman, versus the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan. Like I said, in a Falls Count Anywhere match. And sort of the storyline is that, you know, there was this sort of alliance going on between the Four Horsemen and the Dungeon of Doom in the effort to destroy Hulkamania. And Kevin Sullivan had, like, thrown Brian Pillman out of the Four Horsemen because he wasn't Horseman material. And he didn't believe that Benoit was Horseman material, and he was going to prove it with this match. I really enjoyed this match. Here's the basic match. Benoit comes in first, Taskmaster's coming down, they meet in the highway, they start brawling, they go over the rail, they go up the stairs, they fight in a bathroom. I'm not kidding. They go out of the bathroom, they go back down the stairs, they go into the ring, they wrestle around the ringside. Benoit finally then takes a table out, he throws the Taskmaster in, he puts the table on top of a corner. Like, folded out, but on top of a corner. Not, like, vertical on a quarter. I mean, like, literally the flat surface of the corner. As if I'm going to do this big move off the top rope. And now I have a platform to do it from. Which is exactly what happened. Because he gets the Taskmaster up. Taskmaster. I don't know why I see this word. I want to go Taskmaster, but Taskmaster on the top rope and performs a superplex off the table and picks up the 1-2-3. This is a really good match. I mean, I make it sound simple. It's really not. It was just brutal. And when they went into the bathroom, it's like, how would you like to have been in there taking a piss? When all of a sudden, here comes Kevin Sullivan dragging Chris Benoit and it's slamming his head in a bathroom door. All I'm saying is that, thank God, I think WCW security said, we're going to be coming in here in a few minutes. Y'all might need to start hurrying up. Like, if you're taking a shit, pick up your pants and get the frig out. Because, yep, they're coming in. I mean, I do have some things I didn't like. Like, in a false count anywhere match, you want to see more locations, and I wish it would have taken it to more places than just the men's room. Like, maybe a concession stand or something like that. Like, I understand they can't go all around the arena, but, like, go into a concession stand or something like that. That would have been great. I mean, Benoit's fall back down the stairs as Taskmaster. one day I'm going to get the word right. Taskmaster. But kicking him down the stairs, that was wicked. By the way, though, the match also had the line of the night from Dusty. There's a lady in the men's bathroom! Oh my God, there's a lady in the men's bathroom! There's a lady in the men's bathroom! That was like the most Here's Taskmaster Kevin Sullivan slamming Benoit, slamming a door on the head of Benoit. He got him trapped between the stall doors and slamming the stall door on his head. And his fascination is that there's a lady in the men's room. I'm like, oh, Dusty, never change. You are so golden. May you rest in peace. But yeah. Really enjoyable match. High energy. Very entertaining. And next, we have another entertaining match because we also have probably what's the most underrated match on this entire card. At 16 minutes, 30 seconds, it was the third longest match of the night as Sting faced Lord Steven Regal. Like I said, another really good wrestling match. Sting and Regal had great chemistry all through this match. It's another one of those of Regal being a great heel and just beating down on Sting and beating down, you know, after the initial conflict of the match starting and the back and forth, Regal gets control and he's just grinding Sting down and down and down till Sting starts doing his comeback. And it's just right from there, the only thing I didn't like about it is the Scorpion Deathlock out of nowhere. It's seemingly out of nowhere. Like, it just, the end comes very, very suddenly, and that's like build up, but you think there's gonna be another small grind down by Regal before another comeback and then the finish. But just go a counter right to the Scorpion Deathlock, and Regal, I think, taps a little too fast. Like, I never got the sort of psychology of tapping fast. Like, I mean, I think it's supposed to be, like, they know they're caught, so rather than be put in excruciating pain, they tap out fast. But they seem to be tapping out before the move's even locked in. And it's like, I would like to see them at least go through a little bit of pain before tapping out. It's just my personal preference. It's my little pet peeve, so to speak. But, yeah, the biggest thing, though, and really what I think makes this match go, is not Sting, actually. It's Regal. And I think it showed that Regal was very underrated for what he brought to WCW. I mean, mind you, I know they made him, like, television champion and stuff like that, but still, I think Vit was very underrated in what he could do. He had outstanding matches all the time, and yeah, I mean, like, they were absolutely outstanding, and this match is no different. Outstanding match. Probably the second best match of the night. We'll see. It's competing with the Benoit Kevin Sullivan match in my mind. Our next match was actually the longest match of the night. We had 20 minutes and 51 seconds, by the way. I didn't think I'd tell you the time of Regal versus Sting. It was 16 minutes and 30 seconds. That's why it's the third longest. This is the first longest match of the night, excuse me, at 20 minutes, 51 seconds, and that is the Legends of the Mat versus the Legends of the Gridiron, as Michael Buffer would say, as Ric Flair and Arn Anderson with woman Miss Elizabeth and their coach, Bobby the Brain Heenan, faced off against Steve McNichols, Kevin Green, who was at that time the linebacker for the Carolina Panthers, and with their coach, Macho Man Randy Savage. You know, I made mention to this event being historic for the Horsemen. I did not bring up that after the Benoit Kevin Sullivan match, Arn Anderson comes out, and you think he's going to join Sullivan in beating up on Benoit, and instead attack Sullivan, and him and Benoit just beat the holy hell out of Sullivan. They immediately go backstage where there's a promo with Ric Flair, and Arn Anderson cuts a promo and is like, Benoit proved tonight that going through the grinder or whatever, that he is horseman material. And how he never liked Sullivan, and it was a really great promo that also led to them talking about this match. And the couple of notes I have on this is that, one, it was as good as it could have been, but it just felt like it went too long. Like, it was as good as it could have been, considering that you had an actual NFL player with really no wrestling experience, and a retired NFL player with some wrestling experience, because here comes Mongo! And it's a how do I put this? Well, let me start with the main reason, and that is that you could smell the twist coming a mile away. And if you could smell it before the match even started, or even just by knowing the history, you damn well knew it. When Tony Schiavone says during the very early on in the match, when McMichael is like wrestling, I think Arn Anderson, and he's the main one in there wrestling because, you know, to cover up for the fact that Green has really no wrestling experience whatsoever. I mean, he really only does some basic, you know, basic moves, clotheslines, body slams. I think he does a drop kick. I can't remember if it's him or McMichael who does the figure four on Ric Flair, but that's besides the point. But, you know, he makes a comment that he, like, I talked to Steve McMichael today, and I asked him, like, why'd he go to the Green Bay Packers, you know, the rivals of his arch enemy, the Chicago Bears? Because at some point, McMichael's in his career left the Chicago Bears and went to the Green Bay Packers. And he said, it was all about money. And I'm like, aha! A clue, Sherlock. I smell a clue. And, yeah, like I said, it just were very standard. So, yeah, classic celebrity versus wrestlers. You know, the wrestlers get an advantage. There's a hot tag. And, sort of, Kevin Green comes in hot, does very simple maneuvers. And they do that, I think, one time too many, because they do it with McMichael, who gets a hot tag to Green, and Green gets beat down a bit. He gets a hot tag to McMichaels, who himself gets beat up and brings Green back in for one more hot tag. And he's beating them up, and there's an event to where the female, because by the way, McMichael came down with Deborah McMichael, who was in a sort of a Chicago Bears jacket, and I guess whoever Green came with, who she was in, a Panthers jacket, and they get chased to the back by Woman and Miss Elizabeth, but and this is like halfway through the match, and then Deborah McMichael's come back later in a gown and a briefcase. And it's around the time that Green is starting to come back, but he gets beat down and he's trying to get to the corner for a tag. And Deborah is like, calls McMichael's over, opens the case, there's a Four Horsemen t-shirt in there and money. And then Green gets to the corner, like, McMichael, Steve, what are you doing? Closes the case, knocks Green on the head. Ric Flair gets the 1-2-3. And at that point, McMichaels officially joins Chris Benoit. Because, by the way, Chris Benoit comes out at this time to, like, beat up on Macho Man. He had done it a couple minutes earlier. You have Benoit, McMichaels, Flair, and Arn Anderson in the ring. The new Four Horsemen. And, yeah, this match went way too long. Like, everything's pretty standard. Like, when you think about sort of a celebrity wrestling match, this is a celebrity wrestling match, in a way. You know, the celebrity knows is taught very basic moves, does not do a lot. I mean, he takes more of a beating than I thought, which, you know, was probably giving the office of the Carolina Panthers a heart attack or two. Did as good as it could have been. And again, that was mostly due to the fact that you could smell, and I do mean smell like a bloodhound, that twist coming a mile away. Even if you don't know the history of the Four Horsemen. Because to an extent, I didn't know when McMichael officially joined the Four Horsemen. I knew he joined the Four Horsemen. I didn't know when he officially joined the Four Horsemen. And, yeah, I do now. But I would imagine if somebody didn't know Steve McMichael's history, didn't know who he was, and, like, this was the first instance of seeing him, they could still tell, like, somebody's gonna turn on somebody. Because you could smell it. It was coming. That brings us to our last match of the night. And that took a time of 9 minutes and 21 seconds and was for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. As Lex Luger challenged the Giant, a.k.a. the Big Show, for that championship. Now, mind you, in between this and the last match was the famed Scott Hall, Kevin Nash segment with Eric Bischoff, where he's interviewing him, and Eric Bischoff says, I've talked to the WCW board, and we're going to accept your challenge, and we're going to face you at Bass at the Beach in a war. You want a war, you got a war. And they say, well, it's us and our third guy. Well, who's your third guy? Like, you'll find out when we tell you. And all that, and that leads to them powerbombing Bischoff through the table. That's right next to the ramp. And that happens. So that kind of has an impact on Luger, who, when he comes out, he is concerned about Bischoff and asking about him. Of course, you know, Dusty's left alone on the mic because Tony Schiavone goes down to check on Bischoff for a bit before coming up. And they take him off on a gurney. And I bring that up because that is something that's very obvious in the match, is that Luger, like, right before it begins, it shows, like, he has very much concern, that he sort of crossed between what has happened to Bischoff and his match. But he goes head first. And the thing is, the match itself is really nothing to write home about. It's a pretty standard match. It's a pretty standard Lex Luger match. But it's a pretty standard, can the really strong good guy pick up the really heavy bad guy? But like I said, I think it's hurt, though, by the events of the Outsiders powerbombing Eric Bischoff. Because it's like, that was a major event. Like, if that had, like, been at the end, I mean, I understand why they couldn't put it after the championship, but maybe if that was in the middle or somewhere else, there could have been, I think, more excitement for the main event. But I think it took all the thunder and the wind out of the main event, because a lot of people were shocked by what happened. And then you add the fact that this is a pretty standard match. It ends in the pretty standard, he can't quite pick him up, and the big guy falls really hard on the head, neck, and shoulders of the really strong guy. That's a really big word that I'm not going to try to attempt to say. So, really, really hurts him. And thus, gives him an opportunity to pick him up and hit his finisher. If that's what you guessed what happened, which is like one of two options, you're right. Because that's exactly what happens. He goes to put him in the torture rack, falls forward. I'm about to call him Big Show, by the way. But the Giant falls on top of him, takes the strap down, says, time for the chokeslam, picks him up, hits the chokeslam. 1, 2, 3. Giant is still your champion. You see what I'm saying? Like, there's really not much to it. Like, they tried to make it seem more, but like I said, with the thunder taken out of it from what had happened right before the main event in that promo, I don't think a lot of people were really into it, and it's... Especially when you had that long, long tag team battle of the Legends of the Gridiron versus the Legends of the Mat. That had a twist. It's like, you had a twist at the end of that match with a betrayal! Betrayal! Betray you! I don't have the button, by the way. And then this, it's like, it took away from it. It was really boring. I mean, you had both wrestlers in black trunks, basically. I mean, if this was in Japan, you might mistake it for a Young Lion match. If you didn't know a title was at hand. But yeah. Was a pretty subpar main event. So, that leaves final thoughts for this. Or at least the home stretch. So, let's start as we usually do. Top three moments. Number three for me would be the betrayal of Steve McMichaels. Scratch that. That's probably number four. Now that I'm thinking of it, number three is definitely the entire part of the Benoit Sullivan match that took place in the bathroom, which was most of the match, actually. If for nothing else, because it has the line of Dusty going, there's a lady in the men's bathroom! There's a lady in the men's bathroom! And it was just brutal. It's like, I do believe Benoit and Sullivan had to take a shower after that match. Number two, because, by the way, I could make all three of these spots, any number of spots from the Mysterio Malenko match, by the way. But number two, because it has such historical importance, Kevin Nash powerbombing Eric Bischoff off the stage through the table. And that landing, that could not have been the way that Bischoff wanted to land on that table. I'm just saying. I saw it, even though I've seen it many times, but I saw it while watching this, and all that played in my head was Mick Foley from One Night Stand 2005, where Mike Awesome powerbombs Tanaka through a table on the outside, from the apron through a table that's all, it's like put up on the railing, and he goes, and he's talking about how that was not the way. If you get powerbombed and stuff, you don't want to ever be powerbombed enough, but if you do, that's not the way you hope to be powerbombed through it. It's like, that statement kept running through my mind, because like, whoo, I don't think Bischoff was meant to land that way. I mean, give Bischoff some credit for taking a wicked bump. But number one, it's the biggest move of the match. It's that springboard somersault plancha, which they play if you watch the Monday Night Wars and the Flight of the Cruiserweights. They show that spot. It's just absolutely an amazing spot. It really is. Whereas I would rather call it the springboard somersault seated senton. It's a more descriptive way of saying it. Top three matches of the night. Number three, Chris Benoit versus the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan, I said, right? In the Falls Count Anywhere match. Outstanding match for that. Number two, Sting versus Lord Steven Regal. Really outstanding match. Absolutely love it. And number one, like I said, match of the night for the Cruiserweight title, Dean Malenko versus the debuting Rey Mysterio Jr. Absolutely amazing. Outstanding match. Instant classic. That match alone is worth watching this pay-per-view. But this pay-per-view entirely is a very much of a time capsule. I mean, there are several great matches to watch. The three I mentioned. And then, of course, you also have the DDP Bagwell match, which is good for a mid-card. I mean, the two main events are very Southern Territory-esque. But again, it's like, it was those sort of last hangouts of what WCW used to do. And, you know, how it was changing. You can see in this card of, like, how they were changing things. Because a lot of some of the more corny stuff was stuff that they were trying in 94. It wasn't working, but they were changing away from it as they started to get more gritty, more reality. You know, the Cruiserweights taking more of a center stage. And so many other things. And, you know, you had the outsider story going on and the build-up to that as it was building towards the crescendo that was Bash at the Beach. Great American Bash 1996 is definitely a time capsule pay-per-view. And I'd put it right there alongside Bash at the Beach 1996 with its historical importance because it's all interconnected. So I definitely can't suggest this pay-per-view enough because you have, again, the three matches that are just absolutely outstanding in Benoit versus Sullivan, Sting versus Lord Steven Regal, and of course, Malenko versus the debut in Rey Mysterio. You are seeing DDP's character growth and pay-per-views. You get to see bits of the old, sort of old tag team mentality of WCW with Fire and Ice versus the Steiners, albeit very sloppily. You get to see, because I don't think a lot of people have much knowledge of Conan. I mean, I think there are better older Conan matches from this year that you can watch. I mean, go to WCW Uncensored, I believe it's 1996, where you can see Conan versus Eddie Guerrero. That's an absolutely outstanding match, which, by the way, I had plans on trying to review that this year, and it fell through. But, yeah. But, you know, still, you get to see old Conan, you know, before he joined the NWO. Because I think that's where a lot of people start their knowledge of Conan, which is sad because he had a really big career before that. So you have that. You have the Giant being the WCW champion, who, you know, that was really, really the beginning of Big Show's career. Steve McMichael, you know, being part of the Horsemen and all that stuff, and it's just there's so much history that you can see in this pay-per-view that is really indicative of WCW right before they started to take off. Like, there are several elements of 1990s WCW. Like, there's early WCW that you can really, like, I'd even maybe put 1989 in there, but really 1990 to 1992. Or I would say, like, that, and then there was sort of 93 to 94. It's its own thing. And then you have 94 right up to this pay-per-view, really. Some can argue maybe it started before then or whatnot, but really right up to this pay-per-view. This is where it started to change, and then by Bash at the Beach, that was really the start of the NWO era of Monday Nitro and WCW. And so it's like, it's fun to look at all these little micro errors of WCW in the 90s, that is. And this is definitely, it's the end, or the beginning of the end, of that sort of Hulkamania, we're making an effort to try to compete with WWE, WCW, and the beginning, or at least the storyline beginnings, for that NWO, WCW is taking over the wrestling world, and we're going to soon start beating WWE for like 82 straight weeks, WCW. So, this is such a time capsule, and there are, that, all the historical importance away, there are three great matches, a solid good match, I would pass up on both main events, but, you know, still, it's solid, and the whole thing, like I say, I think is worth watching for its historical importance. So, I give the Great American Bash 1996 a 4 out of 5. And I give it to them because he had the three great matches that are all worth the price of the pay-per-view by themselves. And all the historical importance and sort of time capsule aspect of the pay-per-view. It's why I give it a 4 out of 5. So, 4 out of 5 for the Great American Bash 1996. And that is it for this episode of CM Jews Wrestling Reviews. Remember to check out our website at www.an.132productions.com. There you can find a email account where you can email us comments. You can also leave us comments on Facebook by liking the Absolution Network. We're not that hard to find. We have the AN logo, and pretty much like it, you can find links of this show at our website. Leave us comments there. Leave us comments on Twitter. Wherever you find us, leave us comments. Let us know how you like the show. Remember, you leave us comments, we will read them on the show. Eventually. Because we get so few, we sometimes forget. But that's it for this episode. By the way, also make sure you check out, because I don't want to seem like I'm just forgetting him. Because as I get back into this podcasting thing, you know, I have to get back into all the pimpage stuff. Also, please don't forget, like I said, all the other stuff on the Absolution Network at www.an.132productions.com. And of course, that includes Shin Tiger Curl and all his wrestling videos and anime videos and the such. And that is it for this episode. I can tell you, next episode, we're going back to WWE, and we're going to 2003 for a June event that featured a Hell in a Cell between two Click members. And the final, and the match that finally happened between Jericho and Goldberg. I am, of course, talking about WWE Bad Blood 2003. So, that is it for this episode, and until next time, wrestling fans, I want you to remember that I'm the most glorious Jew that ever lived, and you can't teach that. Why? Because I'm CM Jew, and you better recognize.
You roll a dive and you roll a tide. Each and every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you. Yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me or the air that I breathe. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around, all around, nobody without too negative a diva. I believe, yes, I believe, I said I believe. To feed one, be brought down on one knee. I fight with all of my might and get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight and through the heights. Crown lights burning up, out of through the twilight. So thank you to my God, now I finally got it right. And I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my mind. I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a feeling. What's this feeling? My love will be holding a ceiling. I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Stripping away the layers and reveal your soul. You gotta give yourself up and then you become whole. You're a slave to yourself and them don't even know. Them on